Welcome, everyone, to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. I am your co-host, licensed battlefield guide Eric Lindblade. And as always, I am joined by my co-host, licensed battlefield guide Jim Hessler. Jim, what's our topic this evening?
Well, Eric, first of all, welcome back. It's been a little while since we've been in the studio recording. The topic tonight, after some recent and, dare I say, successful forays into human interest stories, we felt like it was time to return with some hardcore battle and combat episodes. We've covered the first day, we've covered the south end of the battlefield, we've covered Pickett's Charge, but we have not yet tackled Culp's Hill, where, as many of our listeners know, was the scene of some of the battle's heaviest fighting, and some people think could have actually been the key to the battle. Well, Eric, no one is going to say that the Battle of Gettysburg podcast ignored Culp's Hill. So on this installment, we're going to tackle Breastworks, Green, Johnson, Ireland, Ewell, and all the gang on Culp's Hill, July 2nd, on the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. Eric, this is hard times on the right flank, and I'm calling it now. I'm predicting a two-part episode.
So tonight, we're coming to you from a special location. Jim, could you maybe tell the listeners at home a little bit about where we're coming from tonight?
Yeah, I mean, this is great. So we have new friends and new partners at Getty's Gear. Getty's Gear is a retail outlet located in the Gettysburg Village at 777 Baltimore Street here in Gettysburg. They're right across from the tour center. And Eric, dare I say, they are on the western slope of Cemetery Hill. So here at Getty's Gear, we are literally coming to you tonight from Cemetery Hill. Now, before I go on, Eric, I have to ask, is this good ground?
It's very good ground.
It's very good ground indeed. And here at Getty's Gear, I'll tell you folks, they sell all kinds of high quality products at reasonable prices. You got cigars, you got coffee, you got pottery, you got all kinds of apparel and accessories. And I am looking at bags of dog treats. So for the Bobo Sickles in your life, come to Getty's Gear at 777 Baltimore Street and get some dog treats. And you tell them Jim and Eric from the Battle of Gettysburg podcast sent you.
And I should add, they have different size dog treats. So if you have a Bobo, they have things for that size dog. And if you have a Dandy, they have things for that. We can't leave out our good friend Dandy.
No, we can't. So folks, thanks again to our friends at Getty's Gear for opening up their facilities to allow us to record this two-part episode, Culp's Hill, July 2nd. So Eric, in addition to our friends here at Getty's Gear, I think you have some exciting news about a new sponsor as well.
I do indeed. Tonight's sponsor is our friends at PCN. Some of you may know about the PCN Select app. Really great stuff. They have their Gettysburg collection. Well, they have actually gone all in on Gettysburg. They now have a specialized app just for their hundreds of hours of Gettysburg content. I mean, we're talking battlefield tours with rangers and licensed guides. We've got lectures, we've got book talks, including, I believe, a certain co-host of the show.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I know the Sickles at Gettysburg book talk that I did about 10 years ago is a feature on their app, so it's nice to see that revisited occasionally and remember how dashing I looked 10 years ago.
I would highly recommend this. Folks, if you love this show, you love the detail we get into, you need to have this collection. You need to have this app. You can put it on your mobile devices. Take it with you wherever you go. You can have your Gettysburg experience when and wherever you want. To subscribe, go to GettysburgCollection.com, download their app, start streaming the Gettysburg Collection today. Now, because you know, we take care of our super fans.
We do? Yes,
we do. Absolutely. This is the reason we're here. Our friends at PCN have put together a special deal for our super fans. Use promo code Gettysburg Podcast, because we are the Gettysburg Podcast, for 20% off your purchase of an annual subscription. Folks, that's only $27.99 for an entire year. We're talking hundreds of hours of content. Folks, you gotta have this. So once again, that promo code Gettysburg Podcast, all one word, it's not case sensitive. Go ahead, put it in, get this app, and let them know the Battle of Gettysburg podcast sent you.
Eric, what was that promo code again?
Gettysburg Podcast.
20% off for the super fans. What a deal.
So if you are interested in being a sponsor or you want to reach out to us here, you can find us on social media, on Facebook at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast, on Twitter at Gettysburg Pod and on Instagram at The Battle of Gettysburg Podcast. You can also reach us on email at gettysburgpodcast@gmail.com. So reach out to us. We always love hearing from you here at the show. So, Jim, do we have any other housekeeping or things we want to mention? Maybe, dare I say, championships that the podcast has brought home in recent times here as we are all anxiously awaiting this news?
Oh, stop, Eric. I'm blushing. You had to mention this. Yes, I'm a little uncomfortable today because I'm wearing 10 pounds of gold as I podcast this episode.
Woo!
So, no, in all seriousness, since we were last in the studio, my publisher, Savis Beatty, publisher of many fine Civil War and historical books, had their annual Sweet 16 bracket tournament where basically Savis Beatty, myself, other authors, other titles, colleagues, we went head-to-head in the Sweet 16 bracket. For the second year in a row, one of my books won the bracket. Last year, Wayne, Steve, and I won with Pickett's Charge at Gettysburg. This year, Britt and I won with Gettysburg's Peach Orchard. And I just want to take a minute to thank all of the listeners, all of the super fans who came out and voted on Facebook. There was a record number of votes as we narrowly squeaked out a final victory. Eric, though, I couldn't be not only more proud, but more grateful to the listeners, because without them, frankly, we would not have won the contest. I would be more than happy to share the generous cash prize with our listeners, but there was no generous cash prize. But we do have bragging rights immortal, and whatever title of mine that I hope Savis Beatty will put into the bracket next year, I hope the listeners will come out and vote for that one as well. So not only for myself, but for co-author Britt Eisenberg on Gettysburg's Peach Orchard, thank you, my friends, and our listeners.
I should point out, this is your second title. You're only 14 away from tying Ric Flair.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So could I maybe actually wear the GOAT title at some point?
Good chance. Good chance.
Yep.
But as we speak, we are putting banners up in the Battle of Gettysburg podcast studios for our championships. It's going to start looking like Boston Garden here in a moment with all the titles.
I like it. I like it. Yep. Here at Getty's Gear right now, they are raising it up into the rafters. The future couldn't look any brighter for us. We have new sponsorships, championship belts. Eric, what could possibly go wrong here?
And the best super fans in the world.
That's right. That's right.
So as you can tell, Jim and I are both excited to be back in the studio, back joining you again. So let's get to it. Culp's Hill, Gettysburg, July 2nd. Now, as we always do, we put out for listener questions about each episode, and you guys overwhelmed us with questions for these two upcoming episodes. So we're going to try to combine some of them, get as many of them as we can. But one of the recurring questions that we saw was people asking, why is Culp's Hill forgotten? Why doesn't it get the attention of more famous locations on the battlefield when the fighting was as equally ferocious, if not more, than more famous counterparts in the battlefield? So we wanted to kind of start with that and keep that in your mind. And as you think about this episode moving forward, why is Culp's Hill forgotten?
Answer, it's not forgotten. Let's get that off the table right off the bat. I mean, look, in my overall interpretation of the Battle of Gettysburg, in the three-day battle that I often refight in my head in between podcasts, I think it's kind of become too cliche to say Culp's Hill is forgotten. So I'm not going to use that word, forgotten. I will not use that word. But I do think, obviously, as anybody knows, it doesn't get the attention that the left flank deserves. You know, personally, I think that's for a number of reasons. I think, first of all, we have to remember from a historical perspective, Lee's main attack on July 2nd is directed against the Union left. My friends, these were not equal attacks. Longstreet was the main attack. Ewell was a demonstration to be converted into an attack if the opportunity arose. So purely from a military historical perspective, a lot of important stuff did happen on the Union left flank. But as Eric said, it did turn into heavy fighting on the right flank that hasn't gotten, I would say, the same level of attention. Now, I've got other thoughts on that. But Eric, what are you thinking right now?
If you were a visitor to the Gettysburg battlefield, let's say 1875, you would have first come to where we're recording from right now.
Gettysburg?
Not Gettysburg. They weren't here just yet.
Oh, okay.
But on the side of where Getty's Gear is, you would have come to Cemetery Hill. You would have still seen the positions of Union artillery where they once were. You would have gotten a sense of this south of town. You would have then made your way over to Culp's Hill, where you would have seen Union earthworks. You would have seen this battle-scarred trees.
Right.
Of course, as time goes on, breastworks fade away, scars heal, and also access to the southern end of the battlefield increases. And folks, Culp's Hill, it's wooded. It's hard to get a sense of where you are and the battle lines moving compared to, say, standing on the top of Little Round Top. You can just envision the Alabamians and Texans coming towards you. So I think part of it's visually.
Yep, I totally agree.
And of course, we can't discount the impact of more, quote-unquote, pop culture phenomena in the Civil War that have focused heavily on the southern end of the battlefield, a little less on Culp's Hill. But just because it might be, some might say, forgotten, it's certainly been overlooked. This might be a little inside baseball. When we have to give our final oral test to become battlefield guide, we do have to include Culp's Hill.
We sure do.
So we remember it. We take it into account. But overall, it does get kind of overlooked.
Yeah, and skipping around a little bit here in time and place, because I want to back up to the veterans period. But since, Eric, you raised the point about taking tours on the battlefield, there's no doubt today. There's no doubt today that because Culp's Hill is more or less excluded from the basic two-hour battlefield loop, that does get a lot of overlooking from the average typical visitor that comes to the battlefield. So there's no doubt today that the way the park is set up, what we call the battlefield tour, it's basically just kind of an add-on. You know, you want the three-hour tour, you can go to Culp's Hill, but the two-hour tour, it's going to be first day, Little Round Top, Pickett's Charge. So logistics today do not work in Culp's Hill's favor. I would also go back to what you said too about the breastworks and the trees. And again, people who studied, you were absolutely right. And people who have studied photography, you know, will tell you, you know, you look at a lot of these early photos and the cameramen were coming here. They were taking pictures of Culp's Hill and Cemetery Hill and that sort of thing. But over time, Little Round Top, for a couple of reasons, just took more prominence.
I think a lot of that just goes back to just the stunning visuals you have there. And for a lot of visitors, especially first-time visitors, where's the one place they want to see? When you ask, hey, what do you want to see on this tour? What do they always say?
Buford? No, I'm kidding.
Little Round Top. You know, it's kind of one of those must-sees.
Right.
And I think we'll get into a little bit later the importance of Culp's Hill, because I think just because attention goes to one part of the field does not mean that the importance of another part of the field is lessened.
Yeah, yeah. And I, when we do quote-unquote the Chamberlain versus David Ireland stuff, I want to talk about that. One thing I would say too, and anybody who thought this episode was going to be free of Dan Sickles, well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, because here's tonight's second Dan Sickles reference, since we've already mentioned the dogs. I do think the Meade-Sickles controversy, the so-called controversy, does play into a little bit of the prominence of Little Round Top. And I'm going back now to the veterans era, but is the veterans, the Meade supporters, the Sickles supporters from the veteran era up through today, is these guys came back here and had to debate about, okay, did Sickles screw up? Did Sickles save the Union? They started focusing their speeches and their dedications more and more on the importance of Little Round Top and the left flank. And as a result, you know, Culp's Hill kind of got shorted by that.
And not to put on an onslaught of Sickles.
We wouldn't do that.
But frankly, Sickles plays a role in the operations around Culp's Hill on July 2nd.
Oh, we'll
you
talk
cannot
about that.
Escape that. So, yeah, we're going to be covering a lot of things into this episode. So as we kind of get into it, we would want to remind our listeners, go back to season one, episode 3. Maybe our most popular, most controversial episode we've ever done, What If Jackson Was at Gettysburg, Richard Ewell, and July 1st. And we do kind of touch on Ewell's decisions with Culp's Hill. We kind of talk about how important would it have been if they would have had it, what might have happened. So before we get into July 2nd on Culp's Hill, let's go back to the evening of July 1st. And as we do that, I think it's important for our visitors that maybe have not been to Gettysburg or have been here and have a hard time getting a handle on Culp's Hill, let's just quickly give them a description of Culp's Hill. And we had a number of questions on what it would have looked like in 1863. So let's kind of give the listeners a picture of what Culp's Hill would have looked like on July 1st, 1863.
So first of all, I always start by explaining to people that in a lot of ways, Culp's Hill is really two hills. There is a higher hill, which, you know, we call the summit of Culp's Hill, give or take whatever measurement you're using. It's give or take about 180 feet above Rock Creek. And then there is a smaller hill, which again is give or take about 80 feet or so above Rock Creek, with a saddle kind of in between this upper hill and this lower hill. We are bordered on the east by Rock Creek, which is heavily wooded today with a lot of undergrowth. But at the time of the battle, the woods were there, but they were more open and allowed more troop maneuver than what you would see today. Eric, you have any thoughts on that?
I often tell folks, you know, I describe Culp's Hill as Upper Culp's Hill and Lower Culp's Hill. I think that's kind of easier. And I often tell people, it's kind of like you said, it's a misnomer. When we say Culp's Hill, you think it's one giant hill. To get a sense of what Culp's Hill looks like, we have a number of resources. Matthew Brady takes photographs just days after the battle on Culp's Hill. We have a number of sketches and paintings by Edwin Forbes that shows you what it looked like. And keep in mind, too, as we talk about a lot of these locations on the battlefield, today we view them as battlefields, a place where people fought. But a week before this battle, Culp's Hill is part of an agricultural landscape. You would have animals that grazed over Culp's Hill. So if you look at the hill today, see the big trees that would be around you? Imagine they'd probably be there, but all the undergrowth around it, it's gone.
Yep.
That's eaten by the cows and the goats and the pigs and everything else. So it would have been a much more open landscape. You would have also had farming ground near the Spangler Meadow area, as well as near Spangler Spring as well. So that's much more open than it is today.
And marshy. Open and marshy.
Open and marshy. And I think it would also really behoove you to take what you see of Culp's Hill today and just take it out of your mind. Today, it looks nothing like it did in 1863.
Yeah, great, Eric. And a couple more descriptions just to kind of get people into the moment here. So the distance between what we call the upper Culp's Hill and lower Culp's Hill is about a quarter of a mile. And again, as we said, there's going to be a saddle, a low ground kind of in between these two. Now, we talked about Rock Creek runs along the eastern side of it. Eric also mentioned Spangler's Meadow. That is basically just on the south end of the lower hill. There's some woods around there referred to sometimes as McAllister's Woods. And then near the lower hill, there is also a cleared 7-acre field on the northwest side that we refer to today as Pardee Field. Now, that's really going to play more into the July 3rd story. But again, just trying to give people the complete picture here before somebody raises their hand and says, you forgot Pardee Field. No, we haven't forgotten anything today, my friends.
How could we forget Pardee Field? Let's get into July 1st. As we all know, portions of the Army of the Potomac are forced back through the streets of Gettysburg, back to Cemetery Hill in the afternoon of July 1st. When you're standing on Cemetery Hill, if you are a Union commander, you immediately notice the importance of Cemetery Hill. But in order to hold this position, we've got to hold the line south of Cemetery Hill, including Cemetery Ridge, down to the area, ultimately to the Round Tops. But you look over and you realize I've got to hold Culp's Hill as well, because Culp's Hill is higher than Cemetery Hill. That is a problem. It also gives you a little bit of extra protection to the Baltimore Pike. And, you know, I've had folks on tours ask me, what's the most important feature on the Gettysburg battlefield? And I have the same answer every time. It's the Baltimore Pike. It is Meade's lifeline. So a lot of the decisions they're going to end up putting troops onto Culp's Hill relate directly to the logistical needs of the Army of the Potomac and the Baltimore Pike.
That's right. And I would say, you know, if you want to give credit to somebody for first recognizing the need to put troops on Culp's Hill, it's Hancock.
Absolutely.
And I know we have a lot of Hancock fans in the audience. So remember when Hancock arrived on the field on the afternoon of July 1st, he assessed the situation. Of course, at that time, Howard was also rallying the troops after they have been defeated on the first day. But it was Hancock who realized good position, but easily turned. So he sent some of Geary's 12th Corps guys down to the area that we know today as Little Round Top, but he sent some of the 1st Corps over to Culp's Hill. And that really starts to begin the defense of Culp's Hill, where we have elements of Wadsworth's division, Cutler and Meredith's brigade, starting to occupy Culp's Hill at around 5 p.m. on July 1st.
And probably the first Union unit on Culp's Hill proper, at least the highest element of it, would be the 7th Indiana of Cutler's Brigade. Now, you're thinking, wait a minute, Cutler's Brigade, 7th Indiana, what did they do on July 1st? I don't think of them west of Gettysburg, for good reason. They were detailed guarding wagons. Mm-hmm. They were not involved in the first day's fight. So essentially, they're fresh
troops. Hancock needs fresh guys.
So if you're sending anybody over there, let's send some fresh troops over. So the Hoosiers begin to march up the upper hill. Soon, they're going to be reinforced by elements of Solomon Meredith's Iron Brigade as well. 7th Indiana is going to occupy the peak of the upper summit, with the bulk of the regiment facing roughly northward. The Iron Brigade units will be to their left. Eventually, Company B of the 7th Indiana was placed at about a right angle to the main line, facing Rock Creek to the east in a skirmish line. So just kind of give you a sense of that initial posting for them. Eventually, the 12th Corps would move into position, protecting the eastern approaches of the hill on July 2nd, but on the night of July 1st, really only saw one company on the eastern slopes of the hill. So keep that in mind, one company on Culp's Hill.
You know, and we should point out, too, we didn't mention it in the description. We didn't talk a lot about the north slope of Culp's Hill. The north slope of Culp's Hill is probably the steepest and rockiest part of the hill. So, you know, again, when you kind of think about this notion of could the Confederates have taken Culp's Hill easily on the evening of July 1st, one of the things you got to think about, they essentially would have been coming up probably the most difficult part of the hill. Now, of course, it didn't happen, and we're not going to get too into the weeds on that in this episode, but as Eric mentioned, the 7th Indiana, it was in fact Company B of the 7th Indiana that collided with a nighttime reconnaissance from General Edward Allegheny Johnson, a man that we're going to mention a little bit more on today's installment. Johnson sent a patrol, a reconnaissance, to see if the hill was unoccupied. They ran into Company B of the 7th Indiana. There was a little musketry, and that ultimately helped convince the Confederates, more or less inaccurately, that Culp's Hill was occupied that night in force.
And this is one of those moments in the Battle of Gettysburg when we assess this event. We often look to the big moments. Sometimes it can be small actions that have a momentous impact on the overall battle. And this is one of those. What we're looking at is really a sharp little skirmish between one Union company of the 7th Indiana and a reconnaissance party. But think about the ripple effect that it's going to have. Mm-hmm. Now, that reconnaissance party, a couple of them are going to be captured. There's going to be some casualties. And what they're going to report to Edward Johnson is, hey, there's Union troops up there. Now, keep in mind, it's dark. These men are tired. They're looking at that north face of Culp's Hill.
Rugged terrain.
That's a bear to get up. They're thinking, you know what? This might be a little too much to bite off right now. Let's maybe wait until tomorrow and reassess this. So kind of keep that in mind as we look at that position, because it's easy to say, well, gee, Edward Johnson should have just rushed up the hill and taken it. We know that after the fact. But in the moment, put yourself in his shoes, it's a different story.
Which also brings up the point, too, of not only have we talked about the terrain and the darkness and the difficulty of doing it, but we should start to talk about the construction of breastworks on the hill itself. And, you know, many people often ascribe this to George Green in the 12th Corps, who, of course, we will talk a lot about over the course of the next two episodes. But we both believe that the breastworks on the northern slope of Culp's Hill were, in fact, probably started by Colonel Rufus Dawes of the 6th Wisconsin. So we have a little bit of a Iron Brigade tie-in here tonight, but it was Dawes of the 6th Wisconsin, who is near the 7th Indiana, who basically said that his regiment started construction of the breastworks, and then that the 7th's Colonel Grover sort of stretched the works along his front. Other units then kind of take this up. So should we give a huzzah to the Iron Brigade for sort of starting the breastworks and the Union defensive cult?
I think we should. And I think this shows that, as you said, you know, people often say it's George Green that's to take credit. Now, what I would say of Green is Green takes this to a completely different level than what these initial breastworks would have been. And personal note, on my first oral, which I did fail, by the way, I got dinged for actually referring to the earthworks and breastworks on Culp's Hill as entrenchments. I said the Union troops made trenches, and I was quickly knocked down saying those are not trenches. Oh. You dig trenches. You build earthworks and breastworks. So there is a distinction there. There's a difference here. So just a fond memory. Whenever I'm up there and I think about that and I talk about my epic fail on my first oral exam.
Hard times.
Become a battlefield guide.
Hard times, Eric. Hard
times.
It was
hard times. But you know what I did? I rebounded and I got that.
And here you are today. You know, and again, just as a sidebar on that then, for folks who say, come on, how hard can it be to be a tour guide and to pass that exam? Folks, it's moments like that that can destroy a person's career. So keep that in mind for those of you who are trying to study for the test out there.
Now, I do have an account from the 7th Indiana that talks about the building of these breastworks on what we might say is possibly in the evening of July 1st, maybe into the early hours of July 2nd. We don't really know. And as we always tell you, time is a very fluid thing on this battlefield. Nobody's looking at their watch going, man, you know, what time do we start building these breastworks? Write that down. But Orville Thompson of the 7th Indiana stated that this was the first time work of that character was performed, and he noted that it was attended with unusual alacrity. So this is a bit of a change for some of these men. Now, fast forward a year later, what's the first thing troops on each side do when they get into any position on a battlefield? They either start digging in or they start building cover for themselves. But this is this kind of transition point, which is why I think Culp's Hill is fascinating, because we start to see the transition from more open field maneuvering to a more static action that will become really the story of 1864 and 1865.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the thing too, and I think we'll come into this again more later when we talk about Green in the 12th Corps, but it's not just as simple too as just grabbing, you know, logs and wood and piling it on top of each other. There's a science to it. And they would top the barricades with a head log that would basically protect the soldiers' heads while allowing them to fire from the slit between the head log and the rest of the works. So again, people, there's science behind this, there's actual tactics, but as Eric said, the real problem is up to July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, 1863, a lot of these guys didn't really have a lot of experience doing this. And that's something that I think we'll come back to maybe a little bit as we kind of unpack here.
And not only do they not have experience, I believe I'm remembering this correctly, when they dedicated George Green's monument on Culp's Hill, one of the veterans actually remarked that when Green ordered them to do it, they were not happy by this.
Yeah, right.
They were saying, why are we doing this? This isn't our job. This is manual labor. This isn't what soldiers do. But he later said, when we look back on it, thank God we did it, because it saved our bacon on July 2nd.
Yeah, and I was thinking maybe Green, you know, Green coming later in the story, maybe we unpack all of that a little bit later, because, you know, there's some controversy about who ordered what, and I know we had a lot of listener questions about that.
But I think it at least speaks to the mindset of these guys that, frankly, you see it in during the 7 days when Confederates are building earthworks around Richmond. They're saying, this isn't the job for soldiers.
I want
to fight.
This
is menial labor.
Yeah.
You know, so there is a mindset against this still that I think will change very quickly. But that's something to kind of keep in mind, that today we look and they go, man, that's a brilliant decision. You would just naturally do this. Not necessarily in the moment.
Well, and how many times on battlefield tours, I know it's happened to me many, many, many times, where, you know, the visitor, the idea of the Napoleonic open field tactics and that sort of thing, and the visitor shakes their head in disgust and disdain and says, what were these people? Were they stupid? Why did they not fight like this? It wasn't how people were trained and conditioned to think. It's also a function of the weaponry and all of that stuff, but I don't want to get too far in the weeds on that stuff. But it's a different mindset, 21st century combat versus how they looked at things in the 1860s.
So we're going to come back to the design of Green's earthworks in a moment. But I think now let's double back to Richard Jewell and Robert E. Lee. The evening of July 1st, Robert E. Lee is starting to kind of think about, what am I going to do the next day? Lee wants to continue the fight. He knows that. But the question is, where exactly do I do that? Lee quickly realizes that probably the southern end of the Union line is probably going to give him much more of an advantage than attacking the area around Culp's Hill and Cemetery Hill. And one of those forgotten little notes in the battle is that at one point, Robert E. Lee actually orders Richard Jewell to pull his corps to the south, vacate the town, move to the south.
Yep.
Richard Jewell actually kind of talks him out of it. So that's something to kind of keep in mind, that it's Jewell that says, I want to keep my men where they are. course, this is going to play a role later in the day.
And again, I know we did some of this in the Jackson episode, but when I look at Ewell in hindsight, I do not fault Ewell for his quote-unquote failure to take the hill. But I think if you want to fault Ewell in hindsight for critical mistakes, that sort of moment is one of them. Because as Eric said, Ewell more or less persuades Lee that, yes, we can take that position. But the other thing I just wanted to touch on that Eric mentioned, which again plays into the terrain, and as the morning of July 2nd progresses, Lee and Meade, both commanding generals, really start to consider Culp's Hill in that area for offensive operations and then turn their attention away from it. And again, why? Because of the terrain. Trees, rocks, the woods, the hills, the proximity to town, really the lack of positions from which the Confederates can use artillery to advantage, which is something that's going to play in when they launch the attack. The terrain in and around Culp's Hill ultimately is proved to more or less be not conducive for offensive operations. In hindsight, as a Monday morning quarterback, hard to believe things could have turned out worse for the Confederate Army if Ewell had just pulled back. But of course, we'll never know. And Eric, we don't do what-if history on the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. Or do we?
Season 1, Episode 3, What If Jackson Was at Gettysburg?
Wait a minute, isn't that our most popular episode?
It is. People say they hate what-ifs, but the numbers don't lie.
Well, they figure nobody will know who's listening, but we know.
We know. So we talk about offensive operations in the vicinity of Culp's Hill, and if we say offensive operations in the vicinity of Culp's Hill, we immediately think Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia. But George Meade, on July 2nd, early that day, is considering offensive action in that area himself. In fact, he's going to order Governor Kay Warren and Henry Slocum to do a reconnaissance of the area to possibly see, hey, can I get at Lee's troops? If anything, my belief is he's trying to once again build more of a buffer between the Baltimore Pike and the Confederates. I think he's trying to drive them back, relieve pressure on my supply line. What he's going to be told is, sir, we don't really see a viable means of doing this. We don't think it's possible. So, of course, the same issues that are going to hinder the Confederates attacking Culp's Hill are also going to hinder Union troops from attacking from Culp's Hill.
Right.
So kind of those little notes that often get forgotten when we assess Meade, and we often say, you know, Meade's passive. He's just sitting, waiting for an attack. There's moments where Meade is very aggressive here and wants to fight, and this is one of those moments.
Well, yeah, as you said, he considers it, and Warren and Slocum kind of take a look at it and decide not to. So from that perspective, too, though, I think that ties back to our opening. People say, well, you know, why doesn't Culp's Hill get the attention? At the end of the day, and as this second day progresses, as I said at the outset, sorry, folks, but the commanding generals more and more turn their attention to the other end of the field. And again, that is going to play out. I'm sorry, but you don't see people saying in the report, Culp's Hill was the key to my line. I mean, they don't say that. Lee doesn't say, when I lost Culp's Hill, I lost the battle, that sort of thing. But again, because of the terrain, people are assessing it and saying, not a great place to really operate here. However, as the morning of the second day progresses and Meade decides to turn his attention elsewhere, obviously he is going to continue to bulk up the defenses in and around Culp's Hill. So we talked about the 1st Corps has been on the northern slope from the night before. The 1st Division of the 12th Corps has been around Culp's Hill, kind of in and around the eastern and the southern slopes of it. But as the morning of July 2nd progresses, Geary's men, who have been in and around the Round Tops, are going to be recalled from that area to come over to Culp's Hill. The 12th Corps will be reunited in that area and will start to more build up kind of a more solid, cohesive defense.
One real quick question. When Geary's men leave their position near the Round Tops, whose corps was supposed to fill in that spot for them? I'm drawing a blank here. Do you have a sense of who it might be?
Yeah, you know, I would have to look in my order of battle. Maybe it was the 3rd Corps. Maybe it was that Sickles guy. I don't remember, Eric. I'd really have to look that up. Maybe it was Sickles in the 3rd Corps.
Hashtag Sickles Onslaught. Now, I should add, when we talk about the defenses of Culp's Hill, I always make the point of when you look at what Meade is thinking and where he's putting a lot of his pieces of his army, he's focusing a lot of attention on the Cemetery Hill area and the Culp's Hill area, and it's not just those two hills that are part of the defense. You've got Powers Hill. Eventually, you're going to have Union troops. Almost to Wolf's Hill. Right. As I say, it's almost the redundancy that if we lose Culp's Hill, we can still control the Baltimore Pike and protect it. So Meade is putting a lot of attention into his, you know, what we'll eventually call the fish hook line. But there's more than just that fish hook. There's almost this kind of line that runs behind it in case you lose part of it, which what's Meade's background? An engineer.
Yeah, right.
What do engineers do? They design redundancy after redundancy after redundancy to prevent structural failure.
Yeah, right.
Which is what Meade is doing with his line. So I think it's something to kind of keep in mind when we look at the Culp's Hill area. It's not just Culp's Hill. It's part of the defense there, but it's the other areas too.
Yeah, it is. And really that whole area, when you start bringing in Wolf's Hill and all of that, the line really looks more like a horseshoe than a fishhook. But you know, when you have a bus full of eighth graders on the battlefield, for whatever reason, a fishhook just kind of works with your fingers. Better than a horseshoe does. But in all seriousness, if you look at the accounts of a lot of the veterans afterwards, and even, you know, some of the early maps or that sort of thing, the Union line really looks more like a horseshoe than a fishhook. And again, it really kind of starts with Wolf's Hill working up again to Culp's Hill. And dare I say, I look forward to our 6-part episode on Powers Hill. I think that'll be a killer.
Oh, that's going to be epic. And one thing to keep in mind with this defense as well is forces have the ability to move very quickly from one end of the line to the other. So I think in some respects, Meade, probably early on July 2nd, is paying attention to each of his flanks. But he also feels, hey, I've got troops in the center that could easily be moving to where they need to if one becomes endangered over the other. Which, gee, what's he going to do later in the day?
Yeah, I know, right? I might qualify easily and quickly, because obviously it's going to take some time to do that, as we'll see later when we try to pull troops off of Culp's Hill. But the whole point, you know, we've talked about the importance of the Baltimore Pike as obviously a supply line and a lifeline. Remember, folks, too, that the quote-unquote horseshoe/fishhook gives me the advantage of interior lines. So not only do you have the Baltimore Pike, but you have places like Granite Schoolhouse Road that can connect the Baltimore Pike to the Taneytown Road, which is, you know, two of the main roads behind the Union lines at this point. So when you have units like the 5th Corps getting onto the battlefield, yeah, initially Meade is kind of positioning them more or less in the lower center along the Baltimore Pike so that they can shift from one end of the line to the other. So again, another advantage of not only holding Little Round Top, but of holding Culp's Hill and Cemetery Hill is this use of interior lines.
On the morning of July 2nd, there's a lot of movement along the Union line, troops being moved in and out of positions as the fishhook begins to take shape. So, Jim, let's get the Union line on Culp's Hill into position and then talk about some controversy that might come later.
As we said before, Brigadier General John Geary's division of the 12th Corps had been around the Round Tops, give or take, sometime around 5 a.m.-ish, you know, while Dan Sickles is still sleeping in. Geary received orders to kind of reunite with the 12th Corps over around Culp's Hill. Alpheus Williams's 1st Division is then more or less going to be ordered onto Geary's right, and as 12th Corps commander General Henry Slocum understood, he was commanding the right wing, so he put Brigadier General Williams essentially into command of the 12th Corps. This then is going to cause Brigadier General Thomas Ruger to take command of Williams' division, and Colonel Silas Colgrove is going to assume Ruger's brigade. Eric, you think with all those movements there, you think we might have some command, control, communication issues coming in later on?
Just a little bit.
Maybe, but we don't want to spoil that too far in advance. So again, as we said also too, the 5th Corps is starting to arrive on the field. They're along Rock Creek on the Baltimore Pike to initially support the 12th Corps as needed. The 5th Corps will get their orders to move into the left flank much later in the day. Right now, they're supposed to be supporting Slocum. So in Geary's division, Geary has got 3 brigades. He has Colonel Charles Candy's 1,800-man brigade. He's got Brigadier General Thomas Kane's 2nd Brigade, and last but not least, we've got the 3rd Brigade under 62-year-old General George Sears Green. Green is going to place his line facing the east, the eastern slope of Culp's Hill, basically stretching from the right of the previously mentioned 7th Indiana. So we're going to have the 78th New York near the summit, followed by the 60th, the 102nd, the 149th, and then last but not least, the 137th New York, stretching Green's line to sort of the edge of this low saddle that we talked about earlier. So you with me so far, Eric? We got Green's brigade facing east, reaching from the top of the hill down to the saddle.
And once again, listeners at home, if you're having a problem following us, just use your maps you have at home. We'd recommend, once again, Phil Lano's campaign atlas. Good resource for you if you're following at home.
Yeah, you got it. Phil Lano's campaign atlas, again, as I've said on prior installments, I have the first edition. I don't know if the page numbers are off in future, but go to page 263 and you'll see a nice map of that. So next to Green, we're going to have General Kane's 2nd Brigade. They're going to extend from Green's right across the saddle to the crest of that lower hill. Now, Kane's brigade, I should mention, is commanded that morning by Colonel Charles Cobham. I think there's only about 700 men or so in the ranks, and they're going to basically also fortify their front line with fallen earth, stones, timber, and things of that nature. Last but not least, in Geary's division, Colonel Charles Candy's 1,800-man brigade will for now form a support line behind Green. We're talking the 5th. The 7th, the 29th, the 66th Ohio, shout-outs for our listeners from Ohio, like superfan Phil, along with the 28th and the 147th PA. Candy's men are going to stack arms, rest, and to some extent help Green's men later on build the breastworks.
So what we're seeing forming right now is a pretty formidable line on Culp's Hill. We've got supports, we're having earthworks being designed and built. And this is, I think, bringing us to one of the big controversies in this time on the battlefield relating around the breastworks themselves. So we did have a number of listener questions, generally speaking, around the breastworks, who ordered them, when were they put in, the traverse, a number of items focusing on this. So let's kind of delve into this controversy a little bit.
Who deserved credit? Because we like giving people credit, you know, credit and blame. Who deserved credit for this? Yeah, again, great question from, as Eric said, from a number of listeners on Facebook. For you, the home listener, we did dive into some of the primary accounts on this to try to answer that question to the best we can. So who deserved credit for the breastworks? Since, as we said, it was not a standard procedure. At different times, Slocum, Williams, and Green have all been given credit for it. And as we often say, success in life tends to have many authors. But I think for the most part, history kind of gives it to Green. Green wrote in Battles and Leaders, "The breastworks were constructed under my immediate direction. Orders were given to throw up breastworks as soon as the troops came online." So notice it's kind of a very dry, clinical explanation. Green says it was my direction. Orders were given. But, you know, it's not really clear who's giving or receiving said orders.
If we're looking at the genesis of this, who really starts it, we could maybe look at Rufus Dawes. We could look at the 7th Indiana. So as these 12th Corps units are coming in, they're already seeing guys building up there. Mm-hmm. So maybe the natural action is, well, if they're building, let's just continue this. And if you're going to put somebody in charge of these works and designing them, why not have a trained engineer do it? And who's a trained engineer up there on Culp's Hill that might give a sense of how to build this properly?
Yeah, that would make too much sense. Captain Lewis Stegman of the 102nd New York, what he said was, and I quote, "While resting, an order came to build breastworks. It is said that General Geary objected to it, but General Green persisted. The men who fought here may thank God for that persistence." I have more, Eric. May I continue?
Oh, absolutely.
Lieutenant George Collins of the 149th New York wrote that Geary conferred with his brigade officers and gave them the option of whether or not they wanted to entrench. And I'm sorry, folks, you know, who dinged Eric on his exam, they did use the word entrench. Sorry. So don't blame me for that.
I wish I had that account back in 2016. Right? Exactly. That would have been nice to pull out.
Exactly. Geary said he was opposed because it unfitted men for them begun fighting without breastworks. However, George Green replied that saving his men's lives were more important than such theories, and he was going to build them if he had time. Captain Charles Horton, Green's adjutant, more or less confirmed that. He said no orders were given to entrench, but permission was given by the division commander to his brigade commander. Green then availed himself of this permission, traced out a line of breastworks along his front. Candy did not, and I don't really know what Kane did, is basically how Captain Charles Horton told John Batchelder.
John Geary kind of looks like an idiot at this moment, sort of saying, hey, you know, don't build these, it's going to reduce your ability to fight. And there's some evidence that he also at one point says, yeah, breastworks are great, what good did they do us at Chancellorsville? So there's still thinking in the mind of, hey, are these things really worth the effort to do? Are they really going to protect us to that extent? So I can kind of see it both ways.
Yeah.
But I think it's easy to sort of play George Green, the hardened regular soldier, against John Geary, the political general.
Yeah, you know, and people love stories by nature where the subordinate is smarter than his superior. I don't take Geary to task too much for this stuff. Look, my kids today laugh at me because I used to use dial-up to get on the internet. I mean, you kind of just don't know what you don't know. I think from Geary's perspective, as Eric said, I'm sure any battle-hardened commander could probably find previous examples where breastworks or field fortifications didn't make a damn bit of difference. So maybe a guy like Geary has legitimate reason to be skeptical.
Not only that, if you're building these, that takes effort. And even though you got thousands of guys doing this, go dig earthworks for a couple of hours. Go chop down some trees. Go move wood and see how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
You're wearing your men out that could play a role later in their combat performance.
Hell, most of our friends on Facebook talk about being exhausted from just cutting their grass. Imagine digging ditches on Culp's Hill. Oh, I'm sorry, they didn't dig ditches. There wasn't entrenchments. See, now I can't get that anecdote out of my head.
It's a good thing we already have our badges. Yeah, we don't have to go through this
again.
Now
we can say what we want. So I don't know about you. I'm going to say I think the officers confer. I think Geary more or less says, look, if you want to build some fortifications, go for it. I think Green, as you said, being the trained engineer, says, yeah, hell yeah, I'm going to do it. And as we know, it's going to save some bacon on Culp's Hill.
And maybe this might be a good time to give our listeners a sense of what this actually looked like. Because sometimes when we say earthworks, we say breastworks, we say fortifications, we think of almost a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's not the way you design these. If you ever want to get a real sense of this, look at some of the aerial photographs they took during the First World War.
Yeah.
And you'll see what almost looks like a saw blade. It's not a straight line. You don't want straight lines because they're easily outflanked. And if you have that situation, you're going to get enfilade fire being poured right down those works on you. So you want to have almost V shapes here and there with occasionally things called traverses, which we'll get to in a moment. When I look at the accounts on July 2nd, I don't think the construction of the works on Culp's Hill was this one massive movement.
I think
it's going to be stops and starts. I think what we see is that probably Upper Culp's Hill, I believe those works were completed before what we'll see going on in Lower Culp's Hill.
Certainly already started.
You know, and also they're there first. They have more time to do this. But I think Green, as an engineer, going back to my point, you don't want straight lines. What you want is what we today would call converging fields of fire, where you basically just need to fire into a general area and you're going to cover that area because you want to put as much firepower on your opponent as possible.
Well, you know, and a couple things I'll add to that is you mentioned earlier, I mean, first of all, we have photos taken immediately afterwards. So, you know, maybe we should post some of those photos on Facebook afterwards for anybody who might not be familiar with them. The other thing I would mention, too, which I had kind of forgotten until I was doing the research for the episode, I forgot in his Battles and Leaders account, Green actually draws a little sketch of this with the traverse and all of that stuff. Again, it's pretty crude. It's pretty cold and clinical. But hell, I mean, it's George Green sketching what it looked like, and I think that's pretty cool. But the only other observation then that I was going to make too, to your point about, you know, it's not some big unified effort, every brigade is on their own hook. So it's not Geary, it's not Slocum, it's not guys like Williams walking up and down the line saying, heave ho, man. Every brigade is on their own hook. As we read in the one account, Green has obviously taken a vested interest in what he's doing. But, you know, again, I'm not sure that Cobham and Candy and all those other guys are. Again, it's every brigade on their own hook. And I think that makes a difference.
And one of the factors we have to look at when we assess the effectiveness and level of construction is the fact that after the battle, these works have been essentially torn down and eroded and rebuilt. So let's think about in the moment. I think the defenses along Green's line, I think, would have been much more stout than probably what we would have seen on Lower Culp's Hill. And this is kind of one of my theories on why Green builds the traverse, is if he's looking at his defenses, I'm looking at what those other units are doing. Maybe they're not to the level I have.
Yeah, right.
I look at the nature of the ground. They can easily be outflanked. I can't assume they're going to be able to protect the flank of my brigade. Mm-hmm. So I need to have a traverse there that if they do have to fall back, there's a defensive work there. Or if I need to refuse my line, I have works to protect it. Once again, engineers love redundancies. So I don't think this is simply Green saying, hey, this is just what I'm building. I think he's looking at the situation and reacting to it.
I think more or less agree with that too. I think ultimately the decision to build the so-called traverse is, as I said, because each brigade is kind of operating on their own hook, Green is worried about his guys. He's worried about his right flank. So he's going to basically put a line here, refuse that flank through the saddle, which again, we call the traverse today. The other thing I just wanted to mention too, because as battlefield guides, people will often ask, you know, is that line that's kind of running up the eastern slope today of Culp's Hill, does that actually mark the line of breastworks? And again, the answer is, yeah, it's supposed to. The first Park Commission planted grass seed on what was remaining of the earthworks to help protect them for future generations. So, you know, you've got natural erosion, uncontrolled tree growth, people walking on them today that are really kind of beating them down. But that is supposed to represent the original line.
And not only that, farmers and landowners there pulled a lot of the wood out of the works that were used, a lot of that cordwood. They're going to use it for something else.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when you take that, the structural integrity of it's gone.
Oh, yeah.
So it just collapses into this mound of dirt. So, I mean, we have the Battlefield Commission rebuilding them. We know the CCC does some work. So, as I always say, look at the photos that we have, look at the descriptions we have, the paintings and engravings. That gives you a sense of what they look like. Don't necessarily look at what it is today.
Oh, hell no.
You know,
no, but what's there today gives you a general idea of where they were. And it's a common question you get whenever you take somebody over to Culp's Hill.
And one of the questions we had from a number of folks is, where exactly was this traverse? Now, I'm sure if you brought in 20 battlefield guides, we would all have a slightly different take on where the traverse is. Generally speaking, on tours, when people ask me where the traverse is, by this point, we're usually by the monument to the 137th New York. What I would recommend is walk down to roughly the right flank marker of the 137th New York, just slightly beyond it. What you will see is that part of the earthworks almost comes to a 90-degree angle, and it begins to jut back towards Lower Culp's Hill. So look at that little point that you have, and what you'll notice is that point is pointing towards a boulder that happens to have a plaque on it. That is the plaque put there by the 14th Brooklyn. Now, I'm not an expert on such things, but I am a firm believer in working smart, not hard. And if I see a line of rocks there, wouldn't that make more sense to incorporate that into my defense than to build a standalone work? That just to me makes sense. So what I think you would have seen is that traverse running from that point to the rock that you see the plaque of the 14th Brooklyn on today, and then probably ending somewhere where the Park Road is today. Some guides will say it didn't reach the Park Road. Some will say it went there. Generally speaking, in the area of what's today the Park Road.
Yeah, and again, to reiterate, nobody knows the exact location, and there are different theories on this. You can Google this online, and you'll find a couple of different theories. I generally believe that the traverse ran more or less kind of slightly above the intersection of modern-day Slocum and Geary Avenues. So again, in the same general area that Eric is talking about. And when I was in my formative years as a battlefield guide, I was always led to believe that the Rock today where the 29th Pennsylvania Secondary Monument is, so we're not talking about their big monument on Lower Culp's Hill, we're talking they kind of have a secondary one, kind of in and around the Saddle and Party Field, that area. But I was always under the impression that the Rock where the 29th PA Secondary Monument is, probably roughly, give or take, marks about the end of the traverse. So again, nobody knows the exact location, but we're in the general area.
And you know, Jim and I have been talking before we went on air today about maybe doing some videos to supplement our podcasts. Maybe this might be a great one to do where we actually walk you where we think the traverse was. Maybe we can do that later for you.
I don't know. Maybe we should get the listener feedback on Facebook first. Do they even want us to do videos? Maybe we should see if people even want this stuff.
Oh, I think any chance they can see us on the battlefield, why would they not want that?
Yeah, I was being a smart ass. I was basically just hoping for a lot of people on Facebook to say, yes, we want it. That's what I was fishing for.
So having gone into, I think, some pretty deep detail on the fortifications and earthworks that are on Culp's Hill and the traverse and all the controversy around it, let's now kind of flesh out the rest of the 12th Corps' line. And Jim, I think you got some information on that.
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, I'll try to keep it simple, but Williams' division, who we referred to earlier, then basically forms in two lines on Kane's right. You're basically looking at McDougal's roughly 1,800-man brigade stretched from the top of that lower hill to its southern slope. We're talking about units like the 123rd New York, the 46th Pennsylvania, the 3rd Maryland, the 145th New York, the 5th Connecticut, the 20th Connecticut. You're talking about units like that. Now, Ruger's 1,600-man brigade, which, as we said earlier, is under Colonel Silas Colgrove, has a difficult job. Spangler's Meadow, south of that lower hill, is marshy and really a poor position. So Colgrove is going to place the balance of the brigade about 100 yards south of that around McAllister's Woods. Last but not least, now we're going to have Brigadier General Henry Lockwood's 1st Maryland Potomac Home Brigade with the 150th New York. They're going to arrive around 8 o'clock a.m. And we got a problem here, Eric, because Lockwood outranks division commanders Ruger and Geary, Ruger being temporary. So Lockwood is going to basically be considered an unattached brigade, and Lockwood's going to be placed on the right of Colgrove's line. And Eric, the reason that I wanted to go into this, A, people were going to say we forgot him if we didn't, but more importantly, by noon, you've got somewhere in the vicinity of about 8,600 Federals, Union troops, stretched from that 1st Corps line on the North Crest, down the hill, through Spangler's Meadow, and over to McAllister's Woods. Let that number sink in. 8,600 men on a hill in a defensive position. Eric, as we segue over to the Confederates, does Richard Ewell have anywhere near 8,600 infantrymen at his disposal?
Not even close.
Not a prayer, folks.
And not just the numbers disparity, these are Union troops behind field works.
Well, exactly. On a hill, behind field works. What do we always say in the Civil War? You sort of need 3-to-1 odds. So basically, to really make this work, if all goes according to plan, Ewell's going to need 24, 25,000 guys.
He doesn't have that.
Yeah, I don't think he does. Problem. So keep that in mind, folks.
So with all that said, I think now let's sort of transition over to the Confederates here as we talk about their planning and their organization moving into this attack on July 2nd.
So Eric, which division commander in Ewell's 2nd Corps is going to have the biggest impact on the fighting at Culp's Hill?
Of course, this is Major General Edward Johnson, which is a name that a lot of Gettysburg aficionados know. But how much do we really know about Edward Johnson? He's not a guy that we often give a lot of human interest stories about and really focus much on. He's there, but that's kind of it. Now, Johnson was born on April 16, 1816, in Chesterfield County, Virginia, but his family soon moved to Kentucky. So if I would ask most folks that are listening, name two famous Kentuckians at Gettysburg, who would you initially say?
John Buford.
Who else?
Jefferson Davis.
Who else?
John Bell Hood.
But to our fans listening in the bluegrass state.
And do we have any listeners in Kentucky? I was waiting to ask that question.
We do. Funny you should ask. We're in all 50 states and 51 foreign nations right now.
Excellent. Welcome, Kentucky. Welcome back.
So Kentucky can claim, I would think, Edward Johnson to this. He's raised there. Of course, he is going to attend West Point, and he's going to graduate in 1838. He's going to be commissioned a second lieutenant in the 6th United States Infantry. He's going to see action in the Seminole Wars. He's going to see action in the Mexican War, where he's going to distinguish himself quite a bit. Later, he's going to return back to the Western frontier, serving in the Dakota Territories, California, Kansas, and in the Utah Expedition. So this is a battle-hardened guy. He's seen a lot of action. You would say he's a pretty experienced officer, all things considered. At the outbreak of the Civil War, Edward Johnson's going to resign his commission, and he's quickly going to become the colonel of the 12th Georgia. Interestingly enough, he receives that rank July 2nd, 1861. I always love when there's that foreshadowing for individuals.
Yeah, it's like we're Nostradamus here, you know, on the Battle of Gettysburg podcast, predicting the futures.
Now, the 12th Georgia under Edward Johnson is going to fight in General Robert E. Lee's first campaign as a commander in Western Virginia in 1861. He's soon going to be promoted to Brigadier General in December of 1861, and where he's going to receive the nickname that most people know. While commanding 6 infantry regiments at the Battle of Allegheny Mountain, the brigade was actually referred to as the Army of the Northwest. He gets the name Allegheny Johnson. In the winter of 1861-62, Johnson's force is going to cooperate with Stonewall Jackson in the early stages of the Valley Campaign, and it's going to be at the Battle of McDowell that Edward Johnson is severely wounded with a bullet to the ankle, which is going to take quite a bit of time to heal. He's going to return to Richmond to recuperate, and he's going to remain there for nearly a year. But what do Confederate generals do when they recuperate in Richmond? They get involved in the social scene. Which I've often wondered, how much of an effect did that lead to the recuperation time? Would you rather be recuperating in Richmond, going to parties and balls, or would you rather be out in the field sleeping in your field cot?
Could vary depending on the man. And I'm thinking, from what I know about Johnson, you know, he's not really sort of the stereotypical dashing Southern beau, you know, working from cocktail party to tea party type of thing. You know, he's considered heavy set, rough looking, a little uncouth, booming voice. It was said that he had an eye problem resulting from a Mexican war wound, which caused him to wink uncontrollably.
Now, he also had a bit of a reputation as a ladies' man, despite this, and it was said that uncontrolled wink actually caused some women to believe that he was flirting with
them. Yes, yeah.
So, you know, there's that. He is, of course, mentioned in Mary Chestnut's diary, which, if you ever want to know the ongoings of Richmond society, just read Mary Chestnut's diary, which is a fun read if you haven't ever done that.
Yeah, yeah. Haven't we all read Mary Chestnut? She actually said Johnson was shaped like an old-fashioned beehive, and that was her description of Allegheny, or Old Clubby, as he was also called.
As we know, and which we discussed in our What If Jackson Was at Gettysburg episode, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, there's going to be quite the reorganization in the Army in Northern Virginia. There is not another division that is impacted more by this reorganization than Edward Johnson's division. Now, keep in mind, this division was once the division of Stonewall Jackson himself, one of the better divisions in the Confederate Army. Now, it was often said that Jackson would have preferred Isaac Trimble to take command of this division. Of course, as we know, Trimble is going to have a slow recovery from his wound during the Second Manassas Campaign, so he's not going to be ready to immediately assume command. So who do we go with? Who's a general that's now coming off the disabled list, ready to assume command? It's Allegheny Johnson.
Yeah, and my understanding on that has always been that ultimately Jackson asked for Johnson, and I want to let that kind of sink in with people, because as we know, Jackson could be difficult on subordinates, you know, was not above pressing charges against guys, as people like Dick Garnett and A.P. Hill, you know, often found when they quarreled with old Stonewall. So I'm thinking that speaks to Johnson's ability, the fact that, you know, A, he doesn't seem to run afoul of Jackson, and Jackson is actually hoping that Johnson will come join him here with the Army of Northern Virginia.
And even though Edward Johnson is a newcomer to the Army, keep in mind he's not seen action since the Valley Campaign in 62, but who did he work under in 1861? some guy named Robert E. Lee.
Right.
So not only does he have Jackson vouching for him, I think Lee would have said, I think he could work in my army. We all know Lee gets the final say in who's coming into his army.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's got Lee, he's got Jackson. I'm thinking the future looks bright for Edward Allegheny Johnson. What could go wrong?
Yeah, experienced commander, solid division. But as we look at the makeup of his division, we're going to see a lot of turnover. Look at the order of battle of that division in the Chancellorsville campaign. Then look at it not even 2 months later here at Gettysburg. He's going to have some good units in this division. The most famous is, of course, the Stonewall Brigade.
Ah, Stonewall. Let me sigh for a moment.
Many of our listeners will know the commander of the Stonewall Brigade, Elijah Paxton, is killed at Chancellorsville. In his place is going to be James Walker, who had commanded brigades in Antietam and Fredericksburg, but's going to be new to the Stonewall Brigade. So could be a little bit of a learning curve and feeling out here. So the Stonewall Brigade is getting a new commander. The next brigade in the division was commanded by John R. Jones during the Chancellorsville campaign. Now, Jones's Virginia Brigade is going to see action at not only Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville, but they're not going to see a really heroic performance by their commander. Jones is actually going to be dismissed from the service because of issues of cowardice at not only Fredericksburg, but Chancellorsville. So Jones is out. In command of the Virginians is going to be John M. Jones. And Jim, I think you got some stuff about the other John Jones in the Army of Northern Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, what are the odds that John Jones replaces John Jones in command of a brigade? But just to kind of echo some of Eric's comments, so John M. Jones is going to take command of an all-Virginia brigade, the 21st, 25th, 42nd, 44th, 48th, and 50th Virginia, about 1,400 or so battle-hardened Virginians. John M. Jones was a 43-year-old West Pointer who unfortunately seemed to have a heavy drinking problem. Actually, going back to West Point, he had earned the nickname Rum Jones among his classmates. Now, John M. Jones seems to be a generally good officer. I think primarily prior to Gettysburg, he's mostly serving in staff capacities and that sort of thing. But this drinking problem seems to be an underlying issue that's going to hinder his career mobility. And as a result, John M. Jones had never really commanded in combat before the summer of 1863. And I'm pointing this out for a reason, because I think we're going to see in John M. Jones at Gettysburg and afterwards, I feel like I'm seeing a commander who feels like he's got something to prove. Now, Lee had reportedly written to Jefferson Davis, "Should Jones fail in his duty, he shall instantly resign." So again, it almost feels like you've got this guy who's trying to prove that he can overcome his drinking problem. So that is one of the brigades under Edward Johnson here on Culp's Hill, the brigade of John M. Jones, all Virginia, about 1,400 men.
Now, the next brigade in the division that was once commanded by Raleigh Culston. Culston does not leave much to be desired by his Chancellorsville performance, and as we see in the Army of Northern Virginia, if you don't perform well, guess what happens? You get the boot, you're out. Now, this brigade has a number of issues. It's one of the few mixed state brigades in the Army of Northern Virginia. Most of the brigades are a Georgia brigade, a North Carolina brigade, a Virginia brigade. This was a mixture of Virginia regiments and the 1st and 3rd North Carolina. Now, I know I am not the most objective when it comes to this subject, but there is going to be a rivalry between these two states, and there's a lot of dysfunction in this brigade. Robert E. Lee has a dilemma. Do I put a North Carolinian in command of this? Well, the Virginians are going to hate that. If I put a Virginian in command, well, the North Carolinians are going to hate that. So what does Lee do? Actually, I think a pretty shrewd move, actually. He's going to assign the 1st Maryland Battalion to the brigade under the command of George Stewart, a Marylander. Stewart will take over command of the brigade. Stewart has a reputation of being a bit of a disciplinarian. He's a professional soldier.
Right.
Good fit to try to whip this brigade into shape. And as we're going to see, they actually perform fairly well on July 2nd, as we're going to see.
Yeah, and so George H. Stewart was nicknamed Maryland to help avoid confusion with Jeb Stewart. Nevertheless, in 1862, George H. Stewart actually did command a few cavalry regiments for a while. So, Eric, imagine how confusing that must have been. You know, you've got two John Joneses, you've got two Stewarts commanding cavalry. It's amazing the Army of Northern Virginia got anything done.
At least they spelled their last names differently.
Yes, true too. So again, nicknamed Marilyn Stewart, as Eric mentioned, he is an old Army regular, a West Point graduate, class of 1848, who had resigned after Fort Sumter. Seems to be a little eccentric. There's a story that as the command crossed over into Maryland, he dropped to his knees and kissed his native soil. Quote, "We love Maryland. We felt she was in bondage against her will, and we burned with desire to have a part in liberating her." I don't know what it is about people from Maryland, but they are just so devoted to that home state. It is crazy. George Stewart was wounded at Cross Keys and then again moves into the Army of Northern Virginia. So to your point, a lot of newcomers here in the command structure of this division.
Now, the last brigade in the division is a Louisiana brigade. Not that Louisiana brigade. Another Louisiana brigade. Now, their commander was Francis Nichols at Chancellorsville. Nichols is going to be severely wounded. He's going to lose a foot. So this command is going to be temporarily under the command of Colonel Jesse Williams of the 2nd Louisiana. He's going to be the acting brigade commander. Now, this is an interesting little note. As I was researching this brigade a little bit more, I noticed a familiar name that's going to take over for them briefly in the fall of 1863. It's everybody's good friend, Alfred Iverson. So everybody thinks, you know, after Gettysburg, Iverson's ousted and away he goes to George. He's actually going to have a temporary appearance in brigade command as sort of a placeholder or a caretaker of this Louisiana brigade for a brief time in the fall of 1863.
No kidding. So a couple things I just want to add on that. Brigadier General Francis Nichols's brigade, about 1,100 men, as Eric mentioned, all Louisiana, 5 Louisiana regiments, but commanded here at Gettysburg by Colonel Jesse Williams. Williams is 32 years old, seems to be experienced at the regimental level, but it's telling that when Nichols was wounded, Lee looked for options besides Williams. So there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of faith here in young Colonel Jesse Williams. Even though General Nichols is not here at Gettysburg, he has what is perhaps one of my favorite Culp's Hill anecdotes that I often use. When Nichols ran for Louisiana governor in 1876, his campaign motto was "Vote for what's left of General Nichols." So we just had to work that in somehow.
So as we sort of finish up with Johnson's division, new brigade commanders, new division commander. On top of that, there's a new corps commander. So we've got leadership changes all over the place, and that's not counting the changes that are going to be coming into companies and regiments as well that often don't get looked at, but are going to be equally as important, I think, at times.
Yeah, no doubt. So not only do you have the command and control issues, I just want to return back to the numbers a little bit. So at full strength, Johnson's division would have been about 6,400, 6,500 guys. But guess what? One of those brigades that we just talked to you about, Walker's Stonewall Brigade, is going to be detached to watch out for Union troops coming in from the east, and Walker is not even going to participate in the assault on Culp's Hill. So, you know, what starts out as 6,400 guys is going to be give or take about 4,600 guys when the action gets started.
And it's not only the diminishing of the numbers of the division, but some would argue at this time, maybe the best brigade in the division.
Right. Right.
Is being pulled off.
Right.
This was basically
one.
Your A-team brigade is being pulled off to Brinkerhoff Ridge and isn't going to play a role in this at all.
Can I just sigh and say, the Stonewall Brigade one more time, and then we'll move on?
I should note, for almost all of these units and a number of the individuals involved, they're going to have a really bad day at Spotsylvania in May of 1864, where basically the division is almost destroyed. So if you ever want to know a postnatal number of these individuals, just go to Spotsylvania Courthouse, and you'll sort of see the end of the road for a number of them.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Eric, because I had that in my episode notes as well. You know, at Spotsylvania Courthouse, Johnson's going to be captured, and Colonel Williams, who again is temporarily commanding Nichols' brigade at Gettysburg, Colonel Williams is going to be shot and killed in the same action.
And not only that, John M. Jones is killed at the Wilderness.
Yep.
So we have this division that really by May of 1864 almost ceases to exist.
Yeah, I'm really not being lighthearted when I say hard times in their future. Hard times.
So now that we've introduced the players, so to speak, what are the orders that Ewell is given and ultimately that Edward Johnson is given for their role on July 2nd at Culp's Hill?
So again, not to belabor this because we've covered it a little bit in other episodes, but focusing a little more on this end of the field. Remember, starting with Robert E. Lee, he had said that it was determined to make the principal attack upon the enemy's left, gain a position in which Longstreet is basically directed to lead this main attack. In the center, General Hill is going to threaten the enemy's center to prevent reinforcements from being drawn to either wing. But on our end of the field, General Ewell, quote, was instructed to make a simultaneous demonstration upon the enemy's right to be converted into a real attack should the opportunity offer. So Ewell's orders are not to make a full-fledged attack, just demonstrate, convert it into a real attack should the opportunity offer. So Ewell is obviously being given some discretion there. Now, what Ewell says in his report is the following. Quote, meantime, orders had come from the commanding general for me to delay my attack until I heard General Longstreet's guns open on the right. End quote. So I'm going to pause there, you guys, and just make sure you appreciate that. Ewell is now basically told, wait until I hear Longstreet open up. And you see a number of accounts of this from the rank and file of the Second Corps saying, oh man, we were basically just sitting around all day now waiting for something to happen. It's hot. We're wondering what's going on. And as the hours are ticking by, they're not hearing Longstreet kick off until about 3:30, 4 o'clock when the artillery and then Longstreet's attack on the left proceeds.
And I've often thought with that, you know, these guys are in position waiting to go in much earlier than they did. And I kind of equate it to you're waiting for your friend to pick you up to go out and they're late and you're just waiting, waiting, waiting. You start looking at your phone, you watch TV, and then all of a sudden they arrive and you're like, oh gosh, I got to get ready here. You become kind of complacent. And it's, to Jim's point, to expect these guys to be ready to go on hours on end, that's just not reasonable. It's hot. They're going to fall back into the woods. They're going to sit down. They're not going to stand the whole time. So when Longstreet does finally open up, you got to get these guys back in the ranks. You got to get them organized. You got to get them ready to go. And then they start moving. Now, there are some who have asked us about the idea of the acoustic shadow there. I don't know how much I put into that. I mean, by all accounts, the Confederates seem to have said, we heard them.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think that makes a nice reason for the delay, but I think a lot of it's just getting these guys into the ranks and getting them ready. It takes a lot longer than people think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so, you know, and back to Ewell's report. Early in the morning, I received a communication from the commanding general, the tenor of which was that he intended the main attack to be made by the First Corps, and this is an important part, guys, and, quote, wished me, as soon as their guns opened, to make a diversion in their favor, to be converted into a real attack if an opportunity offered. And I point that out, guys, because sometimes people will say, I don't really know what a demonstration means. Ewell classifies it as a diversion. We're making a diversion to basically try to support Longstreet in the main attack. So back to Ewell's report, he says, quote, I made the necessary preparations, and about 5 p.m., when General Longstreet's guns opened, General Johnson then commenced a heavy cannonade from Andrews' battalion, end quotes. I would echo Eric's point. I don't think there's any acoustic shadows going on here. I think they hear that noise. They hear the guns. They see the smoke and the dust coming up from the south end of the battlefield. And I think they get up and moving about as fast as they can.
And I think they probably would have appreciated maybe somebody coming over say, hey, Longstreet's in position. He's going to be going in shortly. Can you let us know?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody sends that.
Right.
Yeah, they find out by hearing the guns.
Right.
I think that shows also the issues with Confederate staffs on July 2nd that I think is something that is an undercurrent that doesn't fully get appreciated.
Oh, totally agree. Totally agree. And again, this is, you know, corps, brigades, divisions often act a lot more independently than we think they should. I don't know that it's Longstreet's job to send a message to Ewell, but where the heck is anybody from Lee's headquarters staff keeping Ewell and Johnson engaged in what's going on?
Dare I say, if we want to look at a factor that causes the Confederate defeat at Gettysburg, one can make the argument it's poor staff work. You see it time and time again at this battle. And that says a lot about ultimately who's responsible for that. It's Robert E. Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So with that said, we've got the forces in position. So this is where we're going to cut the episode. We'll pick up the story in part two, which is going to involve the fighting itself. Because we felt that if we kind of went too far, this thing's going to go on a little bit longer than we kind of hoped for.
Yeah, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, July 2nd. Longstreet's attack has begun. Ewell's men can hear it. Ewell's got to make a diversion. That's where we're going to leave off.
So as we put a bow on the episode here, we do want to thank some folks here. One, we want to thank our friends at Getty's Gear for graciously hosting us today as we record this episode. Literally, we could not have done this without them.
No, we could not have.
So,
thank you.
Thank you to them. Next time you're in Gettysburg, certainly check them out. They've got a lot of great stuff here, so we want to certainly have you show them some support for supporting us.
And that's Getty's Gear at 777 Baltimore Street. They're in the old Gettysburg Village across from the Tour Center.
We also want to thank our sponsor, PCN, Pennsylvania Cable Network, reminding you once again, take advantage of their Gettysburg collection. If you love what we're doing here with these deep dives, you're going to love the battle walks, the lectures, the book talks. It's amazing stuff. Once again, take advantage of our special promo code, which is Gettysburg Podcast. Get 20% off your order. You can't beat that. Less than $30 for hundreds of hours of content.
For an entire year. So when you're not listening to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast, which is still free, by the way, you can go over to the Gettysburg app at PCN and listen to all this content or watch.
Not only are we free, we're also saving you money, superfans. Take advantage of this. I want to remind you where you can find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast, on Twitter at Gettysburg Pod, on Instagram at the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast, and you can email us at gettysburgpodcast@gmail.com. So certainly if you haven't, like us, follow us on social media. Also, if you can do us a big favor, please write us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. I know we harp on this, we say it almost every episode. It really does matter. Why have we had some of the opportunities we've had? It's because we're in these rankings. That is because of listenership and reviews and a number of factors. So you have gotten us to where we are. It's your effort and your support that's gotten us here. So please, if you haven't, write us a review.
And in turn, that gives us the time, the resources, and the ability to keep trying to turn out quality, entertaining content for you. So it's a win-win.
So once again, if you get a chance, write a review. We greatly appreciate it. Of course, we want to thank you, the super fans, for everything you've done for us. Thank you for listening. This is the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast.
Take care.